You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 60, the ever-changing oddity that is the Planet of the Apes saga, featuring chimps, gorillas, orangutans, astronauts, psychic mutants, atomic bombs, time travel, ringmasters, prison wardens, the lawgiver, Mark Wahlberg, multiple revolutions, a messiah monkey, and James Franco trying to cure Alzheimer's. Martin.
Yes.
Apes. Together. Strong.
Ooh, help me, Dr. Zaius.
Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Oh, Dr. Zaius.
Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius.
What's wrong with me?
I think you're crazy.
Want a second opinion?
You're also lazy.
Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius. Oh, Dr. Zaius.
Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius.
Can I play the piano anymore?
Of course you can.
Well, I couldn't before.
Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, you ready to get really fucking weird with some monkeys?
I'm ready, man.
So we're here to celebrate the Planet of the Apes franchise, kind of spurred, I guess, because of Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, the newest one that just came out, but also because, frankly, I personally am just a massive fan of this franchise, and without even knowing it, this was a way to actually get you to catch up on the entirety of the franchise, because I didn't know when we pitched this idea that you hadn't seen all of the original movies.
No, it was crazy. So I have seen, I'm a big fan of the new trilogy preceding Kingdom. That really got me in.
You're a Reeves boy.
I am actually a full-on Reeves boy, and in every way, but I had seen.
Are you a Felicity fan?
Actually, I watched it every I think it was Wednesdays. I forget the night.
That sounds right.
But I really had seen the original. I had seen Beneath, and I had seen part of Escape, but I had never done Conquest, which you had told me was one of the best, and I had never seen Battle. And I never really watched them, like, to look at the actual chronology of, like, especially the first five, like, some pretty interesting, like, narrative movement with time travel, with like things catching up with things that happened in previous entries in the franchise, like kind of pretty advanced with like the idea of like kind of Terminator changing the past kind of stuff. I didn't expect to find that in the Apes movies.
I have a take on this franchise, at least the original five films, or really four of the five movies, is that they almost play more like an anthology than they do a straight up saga, because especially from Beneath on, each one with Beneath, Escape, and Conquest, not so much with Battle. Battle we'll get into, as I think one of the major kind of flaws of that movie is that it sort of departs from this notion. But like Beneath, Escape, and Conquest are all different takes on the material that are completely unique and almost feel beamed in from like a different creator, even though Paul Dean is the one who writes basically all of these movies.
Yep.
And you actually get some pretty interesting directors to come in and work on it, with Ted Post making Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and he had made Magnum Force and a weird, like, redneck exploitation movie called The Baby, which I don't know if you had ever seen before.
I have seen that, yeah.
You also have Don Taylor, who would go on to make stuff like The Final Countdown and Damien, The Omen 2, who makes Escape from the Planet of the Apes. And then Conquest and Battle are made by J. Lee Thompson.
Our boy.
Who would go on to be one of Charles Bronson's kind of, like, right-hand men. Each one is so idiosyncratic and weird, like, Beneath involves like psychic mutants who
worship a bomb,
worship an atomic bomb. Escape from the Planet of the Apes involves time travel and almost becomes like a Love American style fish out of water kind of comedy. And then Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, which is still my personal favorite, is a straight up prison movie, a prison dystopian, like a Logan's revolution Run movie. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's incredible, and it's so violent and bleak and weird.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing about these movies is that they're so unflinchingly cynical, even when they're being swinging and fun, like in the case of like Escape from the Planet of the Apes, is that the whole movie's kind of like this weird domestic comedy for like 80 minutes. And then the last 10 are some of the most harrowing shit ever put to film.
Yeah. I mean, like, well, you see the way that one really builds, because there is like an insidious feeling of the main villain watching them to kind of slip up, because he's, you know, he's coming from a, you know, worrying about at what's going to happen to the human race, right?
These are the creatures who kill us.
That kill ultimately. Us. And it really is, I mean, I was, one of the speech, I mean, from Escape with Ricardo Montalban, he's like, you know, if we're going to be dominated, I hope I be dominated by such as you. Because you have other humans who are like, you can't fight fate. Like, fate seems to also be kind of at the core of at least the original five.
And also, have we, like, earned this because of how shitty we are to each other and the planet and animals themselves, too?
Yeah, I mean, you think about the end of Beneath and, like, we're... It's a mixture of, like, the what the apes have become, which is because of us. Like, they're the continuation of, like, our insanity, right? That we destroyed the world, and now we're going to destroy it again. What I think you're right, though, because they all seem like these almost like subgenres of different types of either subgenre of sci-fi or just different genres they're playing with. But again, like, you know, Beneath, you don't see there's some like plot holes in terms of world building of like you don't see Zara and Cornelius and their third ape leave the planet when it explodes at the end of Beneath. But they go back in time for Escape, you know, to our 1970s, and it is chronologically like the kind of the actions of like that film follow. Then you have, you know, Conquest, which follows directly after, or like once you know, baby Caesar has grown up a little bit, finally with the end of you know, the end of Beneath, this kind of like, is there hope that we're not going to, this is all going to lead to, again, in the cycle, the original Planet of the Apes. It's kind of like, that seems to be the core of these films, too, is this question of, can we change? Is it too late to change, right, as humanity? Because they're all really socially minded. I mean, the original was partly written by, you know, Rod Serling. From my understanding, they didn't take a lot of his material.
But yeah, it's heavily rewritten.
But it's basically a Twilight Zone episode for, like, 2 hours.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, and that's the other thing, too, is the... It even ends with the original, with him, you know, famously collapsing on the beach, yelling, "You blew it. You blew it all up." And it's all about the cyclical violence that, like, we kind of can't escape. As it's almost like baked into our DNA,
yep,
at like a core level. But let's get to like the original 68 OG. Do you remember the first time you saw it?
I was in high school, and it was okay. I was just going through like that pre-college, like, I'm gonna go to film school. I got some shit to catch up on. You know, I was like, I think it was the same year I watched like In the Heat of the Night. I was kind of going through the late 60s.
Okay.
And that was just one that I had never seen. Actually, it might have been because the summer of 2001 is when the remake was coming out, and I might have been I think I was probably prepping for that.
That makes sense.
But I remember really liking it a lot, and I really liked, and I still like the 60s version of sci-fi aesthetic, you know, like it's that really that late 60s, still has a kind of swinging feel to it. Linda Harrison is literally maybe the most beautiful woman to ever be on cinema, like on film. I mean,
as Nova,
she's
so fucking
every
hot.
Time I watch it, like she's just like distractingly attractive. And that 60s, like mod girl kind of look, she's like just oh, yeah, fucking
just
kill
in
me.
A loincloth.
Oh good god. And then like, but I do like the setup we talked earlier. I think the series, like, really, I like a lot of the series, later series, better than the original. I like the setup of the first one, but like, it's not one I want to watch as much as I want to watch Conquest now. Like, Conquest seems like the one I want to rewatch.
See, I loved the original. I could, yeah, hang out with it. I've seen it probably 20 times. It's one of those movies that kind of like Jaws or something that you just throw it on, and I just like being in that world, quite, yeah, literally. You, yeah, know?
It has that like late 60s too. Like the production design feels like like Star Trek, the original series, like that really that really cool, smooth, like plastic design for like what the astronauts bring, the way they design the entire Ape Hovel. It's a very cool look back at like 60s sci-fi.
The creatures are very clearly actors in masks and suits.
Yeah, and that's the thing we can't ignore is, I mean, John Chambers' makeup was considered at the time and still as this game-changing makeup.
It's incredible.
You know, and it's funny because you watch, like, we were talking off mic, but something that I really didn't realize until doing this episode, and I watched all these films in 1 week up to Kingdom in order, and I had a great, great time doing it. And was how much, for the first couple films, of a cultural institution this series was. Like, I was sending you stuff like Paul Williams from Battle showing up on the Johnny Carson show, Roddy McDowell showing up on the Carol Burnett show in makeup. It was like, the apes were everywhere. And I wonder if Escape was, we'll get to that, was like partly commenting on that too, of like, the apes are here now. Like, we're bringing the apes to like our world.
They're famous people. These are celebrities.
Exactly. Which they are. I mean, this is probably what Roddy McDowell's partly most known for. I mean, for us, maybe Fright Night, but
this is definitely what he's most known for.
Yeah.
I mean, playing both Cornelius and Caesar, they're his most iconic roles. Like, we love Fright Night, but like, as you kind of pointed out, like, Planet of the Apes became an institution in a weird way.
Well, there was toys. Like, there were dolls. I mean, this is, like, pre-Star Wars.
A cartoon in the mid-70s.
I watched some to research, and it's that fun, like, you know, they didn't – it's basically like
almost like stencils.
Yeah, stencil recycled animation, almost like what Hanna-Barbera did with or Funimation did with like He-Man.
Right.
Where like they would reuse shit over and over and over again, like, hey, that looks good. But like, it's a kind of a remake of the original.
Mm-hmm.
Because Cornelius and Zara are like the two of the main characters, but it's not Taylor, it's three other characters. One of them voiced by Austin Stoker.
Oh, from
Battle. So he's in two different characters in the series. And then there was the TV show where Rick Dowell came. They did 14 episodes. I watched the pilot. Oh, I couldn't find the pilot. I watched the second episode. And they were obviously trying to capitalize. Arthur P. Jacobs, the producer, was like, we should. I think they were thinking Star Trek, right? Could we be a weekly?
Right.
And it was more episodic. But McDowell played an even different character, but again, kind of the same story of I think it's two in this one, two astronauts landing on the Planet of the Apes and experiencing the same shit that Taylor did.
Well, and that's the thing that a lot of people bump against when you get to Beneath the Planet of the Apes is that it's kind of like a chintzy rehash for the first like hour. I find that to be a feature, not a bug, because to me, Beneath the Planet of the Apes has always played like Italian Planet of the Apes. Like, it almost feels like a total knockoff, right down to James Franciscus, who was in like Dario Argento and Lamberto Bava movies. Like, him being the lead and taking over for Charlton Heston kind of reinforces that whole vibe of like, it would almost be like if Lamberto Bava or somebody, or Umberto Lenzi or one of these guys was just kind of hired to be like, hey, you're going to make the Italian Planet of the Apes now. And then you have like the first hour is basically the character that is Taylor in quotation marks, but it's really James Franciscus. And then you have essentially a rehash of the first movie. And then it gets to really what you can tell that Ted Post is most interested in is these psychic underground mutants. And man, that movie takes such a hard left turn to where you're like, you almost forget that it's a Planet of the Apes movie for a minute.
Oh yeah, it has other stuff on its mind. I mean, like, because you're right, until that point, and every time I watch it, I always forget that Franciscus is not playing Taylor.
Right.
Because he looks just like him. I'm like, oh, cool. Because
then Taylor shows up.
Yeah, and because you're like, and I always forget, I'm like, oh, it must be just, and same look, beard, very similar, like, you know, the tan of like Charlton Heston. I'm like, oh, cool. They're gonna have this be the continuation, and then he ends up, you know, you meet Charlton Heston. I always forget that he's in it, not for very long, but I really, really like. First time I saw it, I didn't love it. I love all the psychic mutant stuff under the planet. I think it's really cool.
So weird,
but also like watching these in order. I did not realize all the fucking Easter eggs for fans in the new ones. Like, Alpha and Omega being on the wing is the name of, like, Woody Harrelson's group in War. And I was like, I mean, obviously it's like, duh, but it's like, I didn't know that. Like, and it was
Icarus
cool.
Icarus straight up being referenced in Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yep, absolutely. And so I really, that was really neat. I also just thought, it's a cool question of, like, did all the humans die? You know, and if they didn't, what became of them? And, like, there's some, just the idea, like, also a completely amazing imagery of them taking their fucking faces off.
It's gross.
It's creepy. It's nasty. They're, like, these burn victims underneath. It's, like, kind of looks like gelatinous skin. They kind of look like the bad vampire dad in Blade 2, like the Demaskinos guy, you know?
We don't kill our enemies. We make our enemies kill each other.
Oh, man. It's... And what's his fucking name from whatever happened to Baby Jane? The big dude. I always forget his name, but he's there, too. And it's a weird one. It's a really weird film. It's not... It's low on my list, I think. But I do, like, once they hit... Like, all the rehash stuff, I'm like, you get to the fucking point, man. Like, it's kind of a slog. You're like, dude, like... But once
I just like hanging out with these movies. So like even the rehash stuff moves right along for me. Like yeah. I just really vibe with them. I think it's just it's a total like, is this a feature or bug for you? And for me, it's a total feature.
Well, I think for me, I mean, not to jump too quickly ahead, but like Escape is when I fell in love with the series. I think.
Well, Escape is so different from everything that came before because you can tell. Because that's the crazy part, I guess, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen this 50-something-year-old movie, is that Beneath the Planet of the Apes literally ends with these atomic bomb-worshipping mutants blowing up the entire Earth.
It's done. Like, it's like the end.
Like, the movie ends, and there's no real coda or anything. It's just they're in a final battle. Taylor hits the switch. The world blows up because they worship an atomic bomb that's underground. So, like, talk about writing yourself into a corner. It's like, where do you go from there if Planet of the Apes literally blows up at the end of the movie?
Well, and you couldn't, again, have a more tonal shift when you get to Escape. Because, like, the opening credits of, like, the same ship lands in the ocean. And it's like, you know, Emmett Walsh is one of the military guys. They're all on the beach and they're towing it in. Three astronauts get out, and we're all like, oh, cool, like, is it the return of Taylor or something like that? And they take their helmets off, and it's Roddy, and it's Kim Hunter.
It's an inversion. They totally invert the entire narrative of the first two Planet of the Apes movies by making the apes the astronauts.
Yeah, and by them, and the music even cues are like, bup, bup, kind of moddy, kind of fun, 70s.
It's Love
like,
American
yeah,
style.
Yeah, and they, it's so, it's such a breezy, fun thing. It's so cute and lovable, all of them, like the whole scene of them trying on all the 70s garb, and they're like looking at each other and they're like, wow, look, this is so great. But then the sense of like them kind of getting fat and not light, they're like, kind of like, we miss, you know, they're like, this is like the also the heyday of like American maximalism, right? Like we're right. Just like
materialism.
We're just like in these like big plush chairs. We're drinking, you know, grape juice plus, she calls it, you know, as they call it, alcohol. She loves champagne. Wine. And bubbles. But you know, this one, I think the core of the series, especially the originals, I've always been a Roddy McDowall fan, but he is, no, I'm not saying nothing new here, is the heart and soul of these movies. And he's not in Beneath, which also I think it detracts from him. He doesn't play Cornelius.
No, he
it's
doesn't.
Another guy voicing him, trying right. And not doing
it. He only shows up in the flashback footage in the beginning.
Yep, exactly. And the guy's, you know, he's no Roddy McDowall.
Well, here's the other thing, too, is Kim Hunter.
She's amazing.
Is so incredible as Zira. And that
I call her Zara, I'm sorry. But yeah, Zira.
That first press conference scene where they're basically being interrogated by the congressional aides and everything. And they actually speak and reveal that they have personalities, that they're married, that they're essentially like just like us, more or less. And like, you can feel the crowd getting on their side by the end. Like, that scene is fucking incredible.
Well, the way that they basically come across as every married couple, where he says, he's like, does he speak? Only when she lets me.
Right.
And everyone laughs. It's that whole thing of like, again, we're just like you. And her whole thing of being that sarcastic, you know, or the first time
domineering.
First time she speaks to, you know, Bradford Dillman. He's like, do you not want a banana? Because I loathe bananas. And it's just like,
well, the thing too, where she builds the steps to get up and take it down from where they tried to trap her, and she sits like smugly and looks at him like, okay. Yeah, like the entire thing is so clever and well thought out, but then also doesn't lose sight of the fact in the last reel, that's the Planet of the Apes movies, and all these movies end on the bleakest note possible, going back to the Statue of Liberty being, you know, submerged on the beach in the original.
Yeah, this one is, well, and it all works. This third one especially works because the high highs are so, you really fall in love again with these characters and with Bradford Dillman and his partner. Like, they're just like, kind of, again, like you're saying, like, I want to hang out in this world. Like, this is the one I wanted to hang out. I loved, like, them just being in the city and, like, having fun together and, like, really growing to like our culture and, like, eating and drinking and being society staples, you know, like at these parties. But there is a really good build of, you just watch the villain watching them. You know, he's constantly planted from the beginning of, like, there's something I want to find out about you. Like, what? Because his question is, what happened to the Earth? Why are you here? Like, what sent you back? Like, why? Where are we headed as a thing? And what an insane thought of, like, you think it's upon you to kill a baby, or to basically kill this baby and sterilize them, and so that future never comes. And it's like, for something it's going to be 3,000 years away.
Well, you know what it is, right? It's the, if you could go back in time and kill baby Hitler,
yeah, no, exactly.
Would you?
No, it's the same thing.
Put to the apes.
No, absolutely. It's the same question of, like, and we've seen as the audience, like, where that, what happens. Because, like, for better or for worse, I mean, like, the first film, like, society's fucked up. Like, I mean, like, it's a pretty backwards, it's us too, the way we abuse animals, and you know, obviously the way that it switched of we're the ones in the cages, and the way that we, you know, we eat meat and stuff, so we're, the way we treat other animals on our planet could be seen as barbaric. But no, you're totally right. It's that question of, like, can we stop it?
Can you alter the course of history?
Yeah.
Or are you destined to always live that?
Yeah. Is there again, like, and there's that great, again, the great speech at the end, near the end of Escape, when Ricardo Montalban is helping them. And he says, you know, again, because I don't believe in getting in the way of fate. I'm paraphrasing, you know. And I like that, where he's like, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is the way it's supposed to be, you know. And I also love chimps, and I'm going to, you know, protect Caesar. You know, I will do what I can for him. And the end is just, like, brutal.
They machine gun a baby.
It's crazy. Or they think they do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know. And
they definitely machine gun our main protagonists that we've grown to love.
Really grown to love them. And they're just like, because it's one of those things where you're just like, dude, like, they've done nothing. They're like the most nonviolent.
Well, and Kim Hunter and Roddy McDowall have insane chemistry, even beneath all that makeup.
They sell it so well. And again, just, you know, for both of them, they have the most expressive eyes, you know.
Oh, yeah.
and they, you know, it's interesting when we get to the later films, of so many of these films are about these major, I mean, like, movie stars. Can their performance come through whatever's on top of them, right? Whether that be motion capture and computer graphics, or a lot of, like, you know, very advanced for the time prosthetic makeup. And especially in Escape, you could tell they had advanced even more, because there's some close-ups in that, and then Conquest, where it's really nuanced stuff that, like, Roddy's doing, where they're really confident to get really close to show what he's portraying, you know, through that makeup.
And then it gets to battle and it just looks like a bunch of Halloween adventure masks.
Well, that's the crazy thing is like you watch the TV show and it's the same thing where I was watching.
It's real janky.
It's really janky. So I was watching this interview about, I think it was about the show. And so Roddy very famously didn't like putting on the makeup. Didn't like, I mean, it sucked, you know, it was hours. And this is before, you know, the stories of Rebecca Romijn, Stamos, Rebecca Romijn on like X-Men, these like 8 hour, 10 hour things. It's like 3-4 hours, but like I guess the hands in particular really sucked putting on the hairy hands. But you see it in the TV show and you see it in some of the films, like which people were just basically they threw masks on, like kind of like not the hero images of the film, and you're like, that looks bad. Yeah. Versus like the people like Roddy, rarely, he usually looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. But dude, Claude Akins looks bad in battle.
Yeah, really
terrible. It's just like full on like.
He almost looks like the gorilla from Trading Places. Like no, straight up.
No, dude, he's totally a character from like.
Aldo!
Kentucky Fried Movie, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Which is funny that you bring that up because John Landis is in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. He's Caesar's kid's like little pet slave dude. And I watched an interview with him on Trailers from Hell where he talked about working on Battle for the Planet of the Apes. And he was like, it was a total, what was his exact quote? It was like, it was a total, when do we break for lunch production? Like, we were just
you
can Malibu tell. Shooting in the woods. It was so cheap. It was like, he even said, he was like, it's a real garbage movie. And like, I don't totally agree. I think there's stuff about it too, like, especially if you like the franchise. But by the time you get to it, especially after Conquest,
oh my
which is
God.
Such a high point, particularly because of Ricardo Montalban's performance in that movie, like Conquest takes it to almost like, I guess what we would later know with the Jordan Peele movies and stuff of they would call it social horror. But I guess here it's more social sci-fi because it's totally commenting on racism, subservience, how fascism, and like this entire thing to where like, because you're what, like 20 years roughly after Escape, because Caesar's grown.
He's supposed to be 18.
Okay.
So I think it's supposed to be 18. It's 1991.
Yeah, it's 1991.
Versus 73, I think.
And it's
was
in
Escape.
A fascist state of America, yep. Where a disease has come through and killed all cats and dogs, which I think is like a really funny twist. So apes become essentially not only domesticated pets, but like servants, more or less. And they do all the manual labor and everything. They become almost like a subclass of species that the humans enslave. And then because they know eventually that the apes are going to take over and destroy the planet, they're kept in their place, you know? And it becomes an act of revolution when Caesar rises up and leads these apes in this prison to essentially take down in what they call, what, the Night of Fires, to where they start burning everything down. And, man, it's absolutely incredible, not only because of Roddy McDowell's performance and Ricardo Montalban's, but also the character of McDonald, which is a black man who essentially is the only sympathizer in this white-led fascist state and prison, that he's the one who sees how essentially white people are keeping their boots on the necks of the apes. And it's like, it's real risky stuff because if you fuck it up, it could come across almost as racist itself. But man, it's so good.
I was sitting there on the couch and Caesar says to McDonald, "You of all people should understand."
Yeah, that line.
And I go, "Wow." I like literally just like, but I think the film, I think in my, not to speak, I think it really lands it because that's always been the unspoken, like, I think there's that's going on.
Yeah,
you know?
It's beneath the surface. This is the one, it makes the subtext text.
Yeah, and I remember in grad school, like, we did this paper about both King Kong and Frankenstein the films are lynching narratives. So like there is this, there's an element of King Kong of like, it's a stretch, but like,
keep going.
Yeah, but of like,
you have my you have my attention now. You have my curiosity.
No, but it's like it's playing out the way that our society judges the other and then and destroys them.
Yeah,
you know, and which is often a, you know, people of color and has been in our history. And like you said, this film makes it literal. But I think what's also really neat about, again, the first five is that after two, three, four, and five are prequels. And when you think about it, they went back.
Yeah,
it was just really cool. So now we're seeing what built up to, but they don't call them prequels. It's almost the mentality of like the way that they did the Star Trek new ones with Abrams, like it's a different timeline kind of thing, right? Like we went back.
Well, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, it's a very yeah.
That's pretty clever. You're
right. Putting it in the same thing, but I love that it's like, and but there's enough going on, and you really build up. I mean, the time we spend with the way that humans treat the apes in Conquest, like as yelling at them for being bad servers, right? You know, and again, very coded. And then for me, my favorite scenes in the, my favorite scenes in this film are Roddy Caesar just looking at these different servant people as they're like, he's like nodding at them. They're hiding knives like in their clothes.
That's the best stretch of the movie.
It's amazing. No, it's like some of the best filmmaking I think Julie Thompson's ever done. It's a silent narrative, like, of how a revolution starts, because they can't speak. He can. And he's giving this look of revolution of like, why don't you take that, why don't you take that meat cleaver? You know, why don't you take that knife? And it builds to, it just builds to such a fever pitch. And the end, man, like the final confrontation and the speech between Caesar and McDonald is, I think, my favorite scene in the series, like, period. It's like the core, I feel, of the whole series.
Now, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
And this is something that occurred to me while I was watching it this time. I had never really thought about it before. Is Conquest of the Planet of the Apes a sci-fi reinterpretation of John Brown and John Brown's Raid?
Kind of.
Right? It was one thing that I started thinking about to where I was like, oh, Caesar's John Brown. You have the entire revolution where he's essentially beckoning or coercing, not coercing, that's the wrong word, but encouraging the slaves, quote unquote, to essentially steal from their masters, steal knives, steal anything of use that they can. I mean, at one point they even have a blowtorch, you know, a gun, things like that. Anything that'll help when the night actually comes, the night of fires, that they can rise up and take down their white oppressors. Like, to me, it's the John Brown's Raid part from the Civil War and the abolitionist movement.
No, I think it's there. And Paul Dean, I feel like, is this very well-read literary kind of writer, because like the way
he's from the same kind of class as like a Rod Serling.
Yeah, I mean, the way that he's writing, like,
he's
again,
not that prolific, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, Serling was insane, but like the final speech again, this really almost like Shakespearean like monologue of Caesar's, you know, and they will tell stories of us. It's just like heavy fucking, like it takes the series to a level I didn't know it was, because you were always like, Conquest is really great. And I'm like, okay, cool.
I have the old 70s one sheet framed on my bedroom wall.
I know. And it's awesome. Like, and I want some more. I'm always like, oh, what kind of memorabilia can I get for the house now? I want some more ape shit. Like, I want the Go Ape classic one with all five movies, like the posters on there.
And you can still find that. So here is another Exhumed film story, is that one of the ways that I started really taking these movies seriously is that Exhumed did a Go Ape marathon where they played all five of the originals on 35mm right before, because I remember in Dan Fraga's his opening monologue that he does with the announcements and everything, he talked about how 20th Century Fox was actually putting a moratorium on the prints basically right after they showed it. So it was one of the last times that you could go to a theater and see these movies on 35 millimeter.
So you saw all five?
Saw all five in one day. But they had a massive Apes collector. This is actually where I got my poster from, is that he had in the iHouse on the UPenn campus where they used to do the Exhumed film screenings, he had an entire wall and stand set up of like everything from like the original posters to like the stock from the gun
Taylor
has in the original Planet of the Apes. Like, and he was selling the stuff, and my ex-wife Sarah actually talked him down from, like, he originally wanted like $350, something insane for that Conquest poster.
Yeah.
And she was like, I'll give you $70.
And he was
like, yeah, she was basically like, no, we're not paying that. I'll give you $70 for it. And he was like, all right, sold. She basically browbeat him into selling me that poster for $70.
God, I spent like $650 on that fucking
He had one of the original masks and everything
That's like, crazy.
Really cool stuff that you could go see. But like watching these movies with a sold out audience all in a row during the entire day really allowed me, because I'd liked them before, like particularly the OG, because I remember seeing it. It was one of those movies that was just always on TV in the afternoon on like TBS or TNT or Turner Classic Movies, one of those all the time. So that's how I had always seen it for the first time. And I'd seen the other ones on video, and I always thought they were cool and cute, except for Conquest. Even as a kid, I thought Conquest was really fucking good. But it wasn't until, this is like 2008 or 9,
yeah,
I want to say, when they did this marathon. And I remember going and seeing it and being like my something clicked in my brain where I started thinking about the movies like critically and what they actually represented and how interesting they were, I guess, at least to me. And I was sitting there being like, there's a lot happening here, especially when you watch them all back to back to back and consider what's going on beneath the hood, for lack of a better term. Like, these movies are super fascinating, and they're never less, even when they're not great. Like, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, not a great movie, but still kind of fascinating in its own right, and they're always fucking entertaining and super watchable. And also what helps them, like, the first one's right under 2 hours long. The rest of the movies are, like, 95 minutes.
Or sub.
Or, like, Battle for the Planet of the Apes is 88 minutes long. You can fly through these with no problem.
Well, I just had the experience that you had in the theater, like, me watching these kind of back-to-back in a week. I watched them all chronologically. I think it forced me to kind of see them as a whole. And again, I really was just amazed by the mythology that and the way that that sense of time worked. And again, just like getting into, there's definitely a, while they all are very different films, there is a really great vibe, a mixture of like socially conscious sci-fi with camp. Like, the most wonderful sense
of camp 100%.
And cheese that really lets it go down easy, you know?
Well, it's like camp, the term has lost all meaning anymore in the modern age. Like, people misuse
but real camp. This is camp.
This is true camp.
Yes,
100%. Like, it's goofy and silly, but also takes itself serious. And, like, the very Songtagian kind of definition of the word camp, like, you can tell that it's trying to do a particular thing, but the entertainment and the hilarity of it is sometimes inadvertent, but you just buy into it because they're so committed to the bit.
Yeah, I mean, and how many of, you're totally right, how many of them, I mean, I'm thinking specifically of the first and the third of Escape and the original, are the funniest. Because
Escape is so fucking funny.
It's really, but because they're both fish out of water movies, right?
Beneath
both
not so funny.
No, Beneath is like, and it's
really dour.
It's, well, I mean, it's just like, and really just, it's self-serious, like really, really. Because the first one, how many, it's all these like in-jokes about, you know, subbing in ape stuff for human stuff that we would say, right? It's this complete social comedy of, imagine them living the way we live. Like, what would they say in this situation? How would, you know, this person who they think is a pet, like, upend that society as this fish out of water?
And all the while, we haven't even referenced the Jerry Goldsmith scores, because they're so amazing, especially the original, like, percussion heavy that Michael Giacchino would come back for his Matt Reeves installments that he scores. Like, he's really referencing the Goldsmith scores.
So I hadn't watched them a lot, and I've watched the new ones a whole lot. I mean, Dawn, I've probably watched 20 times, and, like, I'm a huge fan of the new series, and I didn't realize until watching this, and again, in order, I was like, oh my God, he's totally doing the, especially the first film of that eerie, bump, 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 you know, like, it's so, and Goldsmith's probably my favorite composer of all time, my favorite film composer, so, like, but this is him doing something really, really different, you know, but you got that percussion that he brings into First Blood as well, you know.
Well, it has, like, I guess the thing that's amazing to me is that even though they're sci-fi movies and they take place on a totally different planet and they feel of a particular era in American history, like the post-civil rights, post-Vietnam kind of disillusionment with America, and like right down to even like the death of the swinging 60s kind of vibe that permeates Escape from the Planet of the Apes. Like, these could have only been made during one specific period of American filmmaking.
No, you're totally right. And I remember it's similar
to... But they become timeless in a way.
Well, there was this is a really weird kind of... Maybe it's a non sequitur, but like in college, we were talking about Psycho. And the professor, maybe was full of shit, but basically said that... You know, the reason that, beyond many other reasons, that Gus Van Sant's Psycho didn't work is that there's a certain angst to 1960 as a time as well in America as is passing from the 50s to the 60s that can't be replicated. Like, it's like beyond the perfection of Hitchcock's performance, there's thematic stuff you can't repeat. You know, it's owned by its time.
Well, I think that's actually a perfect segue into talking about Tim Burton's 2001 Planet of the Apes remake.
I was thinking the same thing.
That's one of the reasons why that doesn't really work is because he gets all of the design and the aesthetics of Planet of the Apes, but none of the soul, I guess, for lack of a better term, and that you're just watching a glossy, big budget kind of rehash. It's almost like the... like stepping onto like a 20th century, if it wasn't Universal Studios, if say like 20th Century Fox had their own version of Universal Studios, it would be like stepping on to like a theme park attraction version of Planet of the Apes that doesn't have any of that kind of spirit of social change and social unrest that really was at the core of those original late 60s and early 70s films.
No, you're right. And this was an interesting watch for me. So I hadn't seen this since the theater. So it's been almost 23 years. And when I first saw it, I didn't like it. I am a big Burton fan, especially that era. Like, you know, I think his last great film is probably Sleepy Hollow. And
I have a question for you then. Let's just do it now. Is this the movie that broke Tim Burton?
Yeah.
Because he never made really a good movie after this.
He followed this up with...
And he was on a heater streak when he gets to 2001 with Planet of the Apes. Like, all time, like, just knocking off classic after classic.
He couldn't lose. And then he does Big Fish after, which is, like, fine.
That movie's still fucking good.
Yeah, but it's like, he never got back to that height.
But that's schmaltzy in a way that no other Tim Burton movie had ever really been.
Well, it's closest to Edward Scissorhands in the fairy tale. But Edward Scissorhands all works as a piece. Like, it's a perfect... That's the most Tim Burton movie, in my opinion. Like, that's just everything wrapped up in one piece. I think that's
that or Beetlejuice.
I was going to say, those are the two. You know, the most pure, like,
distillations are almost like mission statements of, like, one very specific auteurist director.
We're on the same page. Like, if I had one film to show someone, you're never going to see another Burton film, this is who
this guy
is.
But Scissorhands is 100% my favorite. Like, we're on the same page of, like, that's like the apex of Tim Burton's, like, you know, kind of creativity.
Well, and for me, my favorite, and I think it's a better, that's a better film, but I like Ed Wood a lot. I just love.
Oh, that
I
movie's just, so fucking good.
I just love, and obviously those writers who, you know, did Dolomite, which I love. And, but no, I think this film was really interesting to go back to because we were talking off mic about something we're going to get into in a later podcast of films from the 90s and early 2000s. And, you know, time has been good to a lot of movies that I really didn't like at the time because now we're in complete committee filmmaking time, right? I mean, like, we talk about it all the time with Marvel and just, like, Star Wars and basically Disney in general as the worst culprits.
This, who now owns 20th Century
Fox. Who now owns Planet of the Apes, yeah.
And owns Planet of the Apes.
Now, watching this film, though, like, it is fucking, it is awesome looking. The design...
Yeah.
Is like the sets they built are fucking and the Rick Baker makeup. The
Rick Baker makeup is nuts.
It's a dude, like, cuz especially, I mean, we joked, you know, I've joked with many people, like, Helena Bonham Carter, I think, has never looked hotter than she has as an ape. Like, they make her sexy in this fucking movie. Like, mm-hmm. I'm like, "Damn, dude." And again, Tim Roth having the best, he and Giamatti both neck and neck for who's having a better time in this movie. Because Giamatti's do it with his teeth. It's almost like they did him as dirty in this as they did in Holdovers. They really just accentuated the Giamatti-ness.
Well, that was the funny thing, too, is that you bring up the Holdovers, is that Giamatti was actually talking about Planet of the Apes. He had an anecdote that he relayed. I saw in a couple different interviews where he was talking about, because, you know, he's maybe our premier living character actor.
Yeah.
Nobody has really surpassed him at this moment in time, let's say. Yeah. And so, like, it was, like, I think, like, one of those kind of, like, random roles type interviews with, like, GQ or one of those.
Yeah.
Where they were just going through the years and being like, this role, talk about this. And they brought up Planet of the Apes. And apparently his agent came to him and they were like, hey, we're fighting to get you into Planet of the Apes. We think we have your role. And, like, we're getting you a human, though. You get to play a human in the Planet of the Apes. And apparently Giamatti looked at his agent and was like, if you make me play a human in fucking Planet of the Apes, you're fired. Like, he was like, I'm playing an ape or nothing.
What he's made, his face is
he's
made
so
for
fucking
makeup.
Great in this.
He's having the best time.
Except, I mean, he also has the worst line in it, because doesn't he do the Rodney King, can't we all get along joke? It's not great.
That doesn't go over well. The action is great. The movement of the apes is great. Like, the whole opening hunting scene of the humans, where the apes move, like, they're, like, flying in through the air. The fights between apes, between, like, Michael Clarke Duncan and...
I was going to say Michael Clarke Duncan essentially playing Aldo from Battle of the Planet of the Apes.
They're pulling on a lot. And just the design of their armor.
Yeah.
Like, it's such
Those helmets are so fucking great.
Dude, I have a Thade toy somewhere at home in Indiana. Like, the Thade on the horse. It's so cool.
Tim Roth is just on one in this movie. Like, even if you hate everything else about it, which a lot of people do, we're way more positive on this. Because I'm on the same page. I'm not as positive as you are. I'm like, this is a 2.5-star kind of failure of a film that is still kind of fascinating in its own right. It's certainly better than Battle for the Planet of the Apes,
yeah.
The last of the original five. But, like, even if you hate everything about Burton's Planet of the Apes, you hate fucking Mark Wahlberg, who's terrible in the movie. You hate the nameless woman who has especially
Estella
plays
Warren.
Nova.
Yeah.
She's horrible.
She's real bad.
Like, you hate all of it. Tim Roth and Thade, like, he's on another fucking planet in this movie.
Well, and it's interesting because it thematically too. There's so much crossover between obviously the original five, the trilogy of the you know, not all Reeves, but the kind of Reeves trilogy, the Circus trilogy, and then but Kingdom is trying to get to some of that too, of that idea of how we bastardize, like, our messiahs, like, what's left to us.
Well, that's Kingdom's. Well, we'll get to
yeah,
Kingdom.
But they're doing that
in
also.
Its own segment,
they're also doing,
like,
that in Burton's too. Of, like,
yeah,
they've taken Simu.
Simu.
I think
it's essentially like the lawgiver.
Yeah.
In Burton's version.
Or it's their God, you know, or their Jesus who came before.
No John Huston, though.
Yeah. Well, it makes everything better. But no, I mean, this was not a complete 180, but I was so pleasantly surprised by it because I really hated it when I first saw it. And again, it is a flashy movie with a really great, also great Danny Elfman score playing with the original Goldsmith kind of tools. It has some really great set pieces. Again, Wahlberg is he's the albatross of this fucking, it's up for one of his worst movies, performance-wise. Because he sticks out as so bad. Everyone else around him is so solid and like, really is tuned in. And you could tell there's no way that Tim Burton picked him. There's no fucking way that wasn't studio decided. I would bet, like, $1 million.
Because that's during the height of, like, when they're really making Mark Wahlberg a thing.
Yeah.
You know, he's a major movie star at this point.
They were pushing him as the leading guy. He's really, really bad in this. And you need, if you had like Damon in 2001, you know what I mean? Like someone of that caliber.
Hell, even if he had brought back Johnny Depp to do.
Oh, he'd actually be great.
Yeah. Like you kind of look back and go, why didn't he?
Yeah.
Like, we're on the out. Well, they weren't on the outs because the last movie Burton had made was Sleepy Hollow,
which was one of their biggest hits with Depp. Because Depp was always considered
and Depp's really
poison.
Good in that
he was
movie.
Always considered kind of box office poison until Pirates.
Right.
But I think one of the exceptions was Sleepy Hollow did quite well.
Yeah.
That
movie rips.
I love that movie so much. This one script by Kevin Yeager, makeup guy. He wrote the script with Andrew Kevin Walker.
Kevin Walker.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. So
and otherworldly Christina Ricci performance that, let's say, lit a few fires in me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Her in a bustier it does things to your body.
Also, one of my favorite Elfman scores.
Yeah, it's really
a
terrific.
Really, really
great walk-in role too.
Oh, dude, I honestly,
with those sharpened teeth.
It's kind of one of those movies where it's every time I watch it, I'm like, why don't I watch this more? You know, every time I put it on.
I watch it just about every Halloween.
I try to do it Halloween. It's a fall movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not even just Halloween. It's made for fall spooky.
It needs to be like leaves colonial. Are off the trees. The wind's like kind of whistling through those barren branches.
Oh, man.
Like jack-o'-lanterns are out on the front porch. Like you just throw Sleepy Hollow on and that movie fucking rips.
Yeah, he gets the assignment.
Well, it kind of doesn't only torpedo Burton's career, but it kind of torpedoes the Planet of the Apes franchise.
Oh, yeah.
Which kind of sits languid
10
in
years.
Development hell for over a decade. And then you get Rupert Wyatt's Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which is a complete reboot and reinvention of the franchise and is fucking awesome.
This was one of the most surprising films I ever saw in the theater. I went in...
Mind-blowing.
Because I went in, my dad, I had moved out of my place in Atlanta. I come home to hang out for the summer before I basically was trying to get into the film in fall of 2011. So I was kind of like jobless. And my dad, right before I moved back to Atlanta like that fall or came back down, my dad, we were like hanging out in Indiana. He's like, you want to go see a movie? I'm like, well, what's out? It was August, I remember. He's like, oh, man. He's like, I like the Planet of the Apes movies. And I was like, I don't know. I was like, the last one really sucked.
And this one stars James Franco.
Yeah, no, it didn't. The trailer wasn't promising.
And I like Franco. I've always been, well, liked.
Yeah.
Past tense.
Well, he wasn't bringing me to the theater, you know. And
he was with me because this is still in the Pineapple Express kind of era where I was a big champion of his. I was also a big Freaks and Geeks fan. So, like, I was always on Team Franco and was hoping, but even then I was sitting there being like the leading man on the Planet of the Apes movies. Like this was giving me like high alert Mark Wahlberg vibes.
Well, it just, not even just him, but again, like the trailer being like really, really CGI heavy.
Right.
And I was like, even though this is like 2 years after Avatar, I'm like, I don't know if it's going to end. So we just went. And I remember just like, first of all, it is a really perfect blockbuster script. The writing is so
incredible,
so good.
The structure is amazing.
It's perfect. It's a fucking hero origin story, full on. It's just the birth of Caesar, but you have it's so breezy. It feels like a Spielberg movie honestly, to me. Out of all these films, it feels the most like Spielbergian, especially everything with John Lithgow and him with Caesar at home, that kind of like new family unit, which is very Spielbergian. And the kind of the tone is still a little bit light at moments, like it's very sweet and loving and emotional. But then when it all starts to fall apart, is the direction also, you watch the film and it is like a special effects reel for Weta at first, and like they are putting it all, everything they learned on Avatar, out there.
Yeah.
On this film.
Well, that and Andy Serkis.
And,
Between the two is that...
Joe Letary and Andy Serkis,
yeah,
those two people.
Yeah, it's a showcase for just the Weta Effects company and what they could do. Because not only did they just come off of Avatar, but also, you know, Lord of the Rings, which Serkis dominates in his role as Gollum and everything. And this feels like an evolution
100%.
From Gollum to Caesar, to where what you can do with motion capture performances and what Weta could do with CGI performances and creating whole creatures where you forget that that's a human underneath all those pixels.
Well, and that's what's really watching again them all back to back. I mean, I'm saying something very not profound, but like all of these films at their core are based on human performance being translated through some kind of effect, right? And how do you capture that? And John Chambers was ahead of the curve, way ahead of the curve. And Weta was, through their work, Gollum is what started it, which is what gave Cameron, he said, not until I saw Gollum was I ready to make Avatar. It's true, right? And then from that, they move on to this. You know, and I've talked many times, I got to interview Serkis for War.
He and
Joe Letary, and they talked about the challenges of these films and how they also were, each film they picked new challenges that they wanted to tackle visually. Like it was like, okay, cool, by War they're like, what if we did it in snow? Like they literally put it in snow just to see how snow clumped in a pair. Each film is these, like, you know, and you watch them in order, like, wow, okay, they were being, they, there's a lot more like the hair is not as wild in Rise. But it's all, again, at the service of Serkis's performance. To the moment, the climax of him saying no.
My God. It's still, like, I've seen this movie probably 10 times. And, like, it's that moment still makes the hair on my arm, like, stand up when I revisit it for this podcast. Like, it's such an incredible moment.
My dad, Dave Carlson, is unflappable when it comes to movies. And he's just like, eh, right? Like, that was fine. We're in the theater. And Caesar goes, no. And he goes, whoa. Like, this is like Dave, ooh. Dave Carlson was like, and I called him last week. I said, hey, I'm watching all the Apes movies. Remember? They goes, oh, I remember that. I'll never forget that. And it, cause all of the films have that moment of someone speaking, right? It's always the secret. It's an escape. It's the ape speaking. And the original, it's Taylor finally speaking. All of them have moments of who can speak.
Kind of like Escape. This is an inversion.
Yeah.
Again, is that it's not the ape seeing that Taylor can speak. It's the humans, in particular Draco fucking Malfoy looking up at this ape and being like, oh shit, it just talked to me. And also this thing's about to beat my fucking ass.
Well, it just has such an emotional resonance because what this film succeeded everywhere that Burton's film failed, where you were saying that, you know, you said earlier that like the problem with 2001 is like it's empty of meaning, right? It's trying to redo. This one has something new to say. All this whole trilogy has a much more solid message. And this one, I think you have that sense of at least the narrative building to him speaking. It feels thematically important, narratively important, also performance wise.
Well, the thing about this is that Conquest is almost like the blueprint movie for the entirety of the new trilogy, from Wyatt's Rise of the Planet of the Apes all the way up to War of the Planet of the Apes. Is that,
yeah,
because if you think about it, in the original movie, in the 68 film, you know, Bobby Draper said it best, you know, at the end of that Mad Men moment when he goes and sees it with his dad, Don, and that, you know, they watch Planet of the Apes That's always one of my favorite weird cultural callbacks to this movie is that, you know, it's included in an episode of Mad Men where they essentially skip out on a vigil for the assassination of Martin Luther King to go see Planet of the Apes. And it's this movie that was supposed to provide this escape from this dark day in American history, like this moment of like unflinching brutality during the civil rights movement. And it took one of its greatest leaders away. Is that they're supposed to go see this silly sci-fi movie as an escape from what's happening in the real world. And they go, and it ends, you know, with, you know, Charlton Heston Taylor realizing that, you know, he traveled back in time or traveled into the future, I should say, to, you know, a devastated Earth, and now apes rule the planet. And it's almost like a horror movie ending. Like, the humans are still the good guys here, to where the series kind of slowly morphs to where the apes become the protagonists, especially in Conquest, and the humans become the bad guys. Well, in this new series, the humans are always the bad guys. There's only sporadic good humans here and there.
A few McDonald's.
Exactly. Well, there's Franco, and then there's Jason Clark and Kerry Russell in Dawn of the Planet of the
and
Apes.
And then Nova.
Really no
and
good
Nova
ones
Nova and
in
War. Nova and War, the kid. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the only thing.
And, but I mean, Conquest is the one that really, like Escape starts it, but Conquest really leans into it. It's the idea of like the ape revolution. And that's what is the basis for Rise of the Planet of the Apes through War of the Planet of the Apes, is that Caesar's the protagonist, since it's about him leading apes out of the chains of bondage that humans have put them in.
He's and Moses.
He's Jesus by the end. But I mean, Bobby Draper at the end of that, you know, seeing Planet of the Apes in the theater, like Don explained it to him. He's like, he went back. It's really Earth. And they blew it all up. And Bobby Draper goes, Jesus. Like, can we watch it again, Dad? But I mean, this movie and this series of movies takes the most interesting moments of the original films and extrapolates upon them and builds its own kind of story for Caesar, and honestly creates one of the great kind of heroes of modern blockbuster filmmaking.
It's, dude, I'm kind of a scary fan of these movies, because when I saw, I loved Rise, and then I saw Dawn, and Dawn really, like, I knew I was going to like it, because I was like, okay, now we're leaning into post-apocalyptic, right? It's like the overgrown San Francisco with the lichen and the kudzu everywhere and the ivy every, you know, just covering all the buildings, and they all have the aesthetic of the game Last of Us. It's that kind of like,
well, there's real, and to me, like, the other filmmaker that the Planet of the Apes movies remind me of the most is George Romero, especially with him using genre trappings to make these kind of social statements and stuff. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes gives me major Day of the Dead vibes.
No, that's a good point, because there is the, like, the kind of mad, the military cut off from other people, the way you go crazy, right? And I think that for me, what makes Dawn, I mean, the core of Dawn for me, I think Koba is one of the most fascinating characters. I think that it's full on Shakespearean, right? He saves Caesar and Caesar's son in the first scene, you know, from the bear. And by the end, he can't, you know, get past his hate. And I love the way that Koba's used in this one. And it's not used to perfect effect in War, but War representing in Caesar's mind what he could become if he gives into hate, right? If he gives over into his, like, baser desires to be, he's like, well, I could just kill everyone. It'd be easier not to look for peace, right? And for a lot of that film, he goes, but that's a jump ahead to War too quickly. But Dawn does, I think, it's a very well-told story. I mean, you literally, Jason Clark's name is fucking Malcolm. Like, it's these two guys. It's on both sides, different levels of by any means necessary, right? Like, so you have Gary Oldman, who's like, if we got to wipe him out, we're going to wipe him out. Jason Clark's like, we don't have to go to war. I don't want to go with violence. Caesar also doesn't want that. Koba's like, you know, you have
fucking kill everybody.
He's like Gary Oldman. They're the same on both sides.
So are you saying this is kind of like if the mentally handicapped guy from Do the Right Thing wrote a Planet of the Apes movie?
What do you mean?
You know how he's carrying around the two pictures of Malcolm and Martin?
Oh my God, dude. No, but I mean, I love them. First of all,
talk about a deep cut joke.
Shit. Yeah, yeah. That's the 35th anniversary.
Yeah, Draft House is playing it soon.
Oh, we should go to that. Yeah, I saw the... I actually saw the
top 10 movie of all time.
I saw the 20th anniversary on 35 with Spike Lee there and Radio Raheem in Atlanta.
He was dead now.
He was. Yeah, Bill Nunn. Yeah, it was the whole cast and crew. It was awesome. At the Fox Theater downtown. It was neat. Anyway, I also just love the aesthetic of this movie. I love the Pacific Northwest as the setting.
Well, I mean, Matt Reeves is one of the great blockbuster stylists that we have.
He's amazing.
Not the best blockbuster stylist that we kind of have working in American movies right now.
Yeah, I mean, so Batman is my favorite superhero. Batman is one of my favorite franchises, period. It's like Burton's Batman is like why I want to be a filmmaker and why I want to talk about movies. Like, it's when I fell in love with movies. So, like,
also playing as part of that 1989 series at Draft House right now.
You're right. But to have, I think that Reeves, you know, when I found out he was doing The Batman after Apes, I was like, oh, I'm so in.
You know what I find kind of ironic is that, and this is the thing where is my controversial opinion time when it comes to these films, is that with Dawn and War, Reeves is very much chasing the Dark Knight kind of version of blockbuster filming that took over after Nolan took on Batman.
Yep.
And then even permeated, you know, the James Bond movies with Casino Royale,
especially Skyfall,
and Spectre. So he would then go on to actually make his own Batman movie, which is nothing like The Dark Knight whatsoever. I always found that kind of ironic. But here's the thing, is I actually think these movies, and you're going to hate me, I think they're too self-serious, Dawn and War, because like I actually find them sort of difficult to get through sometimes, especially War by the end once we get into the concentration camp stuff and the crucifixion stuff, is that they're so dark and they're so like unrelentingly grim is that it almost is like they forgot in their dark nightification of this franchise that the Planet of the Apes movies had movies like Escape from the Planet of the Apes that were fun and swinging and goofy and jokey and then ended on a dark note, is that there's only one droning, po-faced kind of mugging to this movie that, well, I think these are still 3.5-4-star, you know, pieces of big budget entertainment. I find them kind of draining by the end because they're so up their own ass.
No, you know what? Like, you told me before recording, you're like, I have a hot take. You're going to be mad at me. First of all, I love you. I'm not mad at you. Number two, it's a taste thing, right? Because for me...
Oh, totally.
I get that. Like, I think War is kind of messy, too. I think it's way too long.
War's way messier than Dawn. Dawn's the better of the two.
I think, for me, I think Dawn is, like, a perfect script, regardless of tone. Like, it is...
Nah, it's to that middle sags, brother.
I don't feel that way. This movie, when I saw it, and I still stand by this, that, like, is one of my favorite big-budget blockbusters maybe ever. I'm not being hyperbolic. Because everything about it works for me, and just number one, the aesthetic. Again, that like Pacific Northwest look and
incredible.
The design of, and also just like the way that I like the simple narrative. It's a simple like idea of,
it's, you know, a Romero narrative.
Yeah. It's almost like it's Cormac McCarthy. Can we keep the fire alive, right? Can we carry the fire, you know? And I really attached to that. So, like, I am all in on that. Like, when I saw this film in the theater, like, again, I was just like, would not change a moment. And I love Koba's Fall. Again, it's full on Macbeth. Like, it's full on Macbeth Shakespearean. of like, I was his best general, I was his best friend, but I couldn't let go of the hate. But then also, there are some action scenes in this fucking movie that are fucking insane.
Dude, the final fight between Caesar and Koba is incredible.
Oh my. Dude, or the storming of the night battle in the streets where it's all like sepia tone orange.
Oh, and the fucking tanks and shit.
Yep. There's that shot. Koba gets in the tank. It's one shot. He goes in, kills the guys, comes out, starts shooting.
Oh, and it harnesses on the actual Gatling gun.
Oh, dude. It's
so cool.
This movie is, again, regardless of all the narrative shit that I could just like wax poetic about forever, this movie is so fucking cool looking.
Well, and it's, I'm on so the other cool end of the spectrum, is that I shouldn't say all of mine, like this is a bad movie or anything, but for my misgivings about it and how I feel it kind of beats me down by the end and everything, I still cry by the end of it between Caesar and Jason Clark's character. And also all of the stuff you're talking about. Like when Koba comes riding in on horseback with two fucking machine guns. Like, if you don't think that that's fucking awesome, you're dead inside. I'm sorry.
Dude, I mean, because Toby Kibble is one of my... I actually like him as an actor a lot.
So here's my question to you.
Yeah.
Is he better in this movie than Andy Serkis? Because I think he might be.
Yeah.
Like his human work.
Human. What? No, he's... Because... Andy is the star of Rise, like full stop.
Yeah, it's his movie.
It's his movie. This movie is the person who has the biggest arc is Koba. I mean, it's the fall of Koba, right? Yeah. And then War is a little bit again messier, where it's trying to like do a lot.
Well, it's trying to be a Vietnam movie. It's almost like Matt Reeves' Apocalypse Now, but with apes.
Well, it's full on hard. I mean, like there's like I mean. There are shots of Woody. He's doing Kurtz.
Yeah, Woody is just doing Brando
all the way. Like the way, instead of like putting water in his head, he's shaving. It's just all these moments. It's like very, very clear. But the whole first half of War is like The Searchers. It's a full on.
Oh, very much so.
The music is full on like Western, you know.
I mean, Giacchino's doing serious work in this movie.
Dude, Giacchino, like, he's awesome, man.
Yeah.
Like, he's a, so my friend.
Is he our modern John Williams?
He's up there.
Right.
I mean, he's doing this. I mean, there's some, dude, and like his score for Rise is really John Williams.
Oh, yeah.
Like the kind of, there's some E.T. type.
Yeah.
You know, very.
That time lapse sequence where Caesar's swinging through the redwoods outside of San Francisco.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely incredible. But I mean, to your point about the whole superhero structure of the script, like that's the superhero discovering his powers moment where it's just like he's fully harnessing like his full potential.
Yeah, I'm swinging on my fucking webs.
Yeah, and it's awesome.
Here we go.
It's his Spider-Man moment. That's the best comparison.
Yeah, and I really, really, again, Dawn is one of those movies that, again, it's a total taste thing. Like, I could watch this every day of the week. I know it's like, because of Koba, and it's about Koba, because like, I think Koba is one of the coolest characters in like modern blockbuster cinema. Because again, he's just straight Shakespearean. Like, I love that. In a fucking apes movie, man. Like, they went for it. Like
and also that scene where he goes and kills the dudes who are doing target practice by being the silly ape and then grabs the guns and shoots them.
There's like, some racial stuff happening too. I mean, he's
the minstrel shucking and driving.
I was telling you off mic, I watched this little documentary, the making of all the Weta work for Dawn. And they were talking about that was the scene where everyone on set was like, oh, like they watched Toby and like I watched him do that scene without the CG and it was all him. Like, they were, these people, and Terry Notary was the guy who did all the training from the square.
Yeah.
You know, he was doing all the, he's Rocket.
Yeah.
But he did all the training for all three films, I believe. But Toby, that I think is that's that scene in the movie, Dawn, where you're like, this is something different.
Yeah.
It's
really special.
It's just really.
As a piece of performance.
Yeah, you're like, oh, shit.
Like it's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, and the way they're just, like, joking with them and, like. There's that shot earlier, first time he meets them, where they're making fun of him, and he's like, okay, I'll get out of here. And he turns toward the camera, and his face drops.
Yeah.
And it's just like, ooh.
It's incredible.
Fuck.
What's crazy to me, just as one last thing before we get to Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, is that because the Matt Reeves movies are so well received, that Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which was incredibly well reviewed, did really well at the box office, and even fans like loved it. Like, I watched that movie. I went and saw that movie 4 times in the theaters. Like, I fucking loved that movie. It's now seen as the lowest point of the new trilogy, and it's almost like, dude, if that's the worst movie in your new trilogy, how good are these films? Now, I think, personally, I prefer it to the Matt Reeves movies. Yeah. But now, and I think Franco's involvement, now in hindsight, that's a major, it's almost like having Kevin Spacey in your movie at this point.
Yeah.
Is that it's like, well, maybe not that bad, but pretty close. Is that Rise of the Planet of the Apes is now kind of seen as this like kind of hokey relic of a certain era of filmmaking. And I revisit it, and every time I'm like, this movie rips. I don't give a fuck. 5 out of 5. Eat shit.
No, I put it, I messaged you about this. I put it in the same boat as Bourne Identity and also Batman Begins. While Nolan is the same filmmaker of Begins and Dark Knight, there's a real change in his thinking between films, right? Like,
oh, sure.
Because I like Begins a lot, but like Dark Knight just takes the series in a whole new direction, as does Dawn. Like, there's a real, you know, and a very even more art, more like artistic look, you know, and much more, like you said, self-serious.
Right.
So a lot of the films that preceded Bourne, and, you know, with when they moved to Paul Greengrass from Doug Liman. And like, wow, look at this filmmaking. Like, Bourne Identity is kind of forgotten about often, or like not watched or brought into the conversation as much as Supremacy and Ultimatum. And so I think it's a very similar kind of thing where when you move to what's like everyone talks about, oh, this is like this really smart, cool, deep version of this character, you forget about the one that also allowed those films to happen.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't have Dawn without Rise. You know, but I was the same way. I haven't seen Rise in years, and I just watched Dawn a whole lot. And I was like, man, I honestly, no notes. Like, this movie
it's
pure entertainment, too. Like, it's so breezy. It moves like a fucking freight train. The end, like, 30-minute, like, the battle scene on the Golden Gate Bridge is crazy.
Yeah.
Like, there's that
when his fucking big gorilla buddy throws himself at that helicopter. It's so awesome while also being simultaneously incredibly implausible.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember that shot was in the trailer. Or the moment where they come out and the cop cars are coming toward them, and you have Maurice and the gorilla, and they're throwing, he throws a parking meter, and then Maurice throws a fucking manhole cover at the fucking
like a
cop
frisbee.
Car. It's so cool.
Which I'd like to reiterate something that I texted to you is that you have major Maurice energy.
And I was like, thanks?
He is. He's the kindly, you know, consigliere of Caesar.
And he's the moral compass of all these films. Right. Of just like, he's great. I love, like, I was joking. I was like, thanks. Like, I love Maurice as a character.
You don't want to be a big, hairy moral compass?
I mean, I guess I am. I am big and I'm hairy and I'm mostly pretty moral. So I guess
it all fits.
It all fits. Yeah.
You want to get to Kingdom?
Let's do it.
All right. And we're back talking about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, the newest installment in the Apes franchise. directed by Wes Ball, who is mostly known for the Maze Runner movies.
That's pretty much it.
Have you watched any of those?
I made it through 5 minutes of the first one.
Yeah? They were like, no mas?
No, and it wasn't like they were horrible. I just was like, it's that very like divergent type of like Twilight Summit. I'm not sure it's Summit, but that kind of YA, like YA sci-fi horror.
Which I guess is a good jumping off point because Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes feels like YA Apes.
Yep. It's, I started off, because you saw it before me, and you're like, oh, it's pretty good. It's a little long.
We saw it the same day, same and day. I think I saw it hours before
you. Yeah, because you were like.
Then I saw Harmony Korine's Aggro Drift.
Oh, we'll talk about that after. but I started out and I was like really, really into this like simple, full on Joseph Campbell hero's journey, like to the beat of like him leaving camp, coming back, it's on fire, it's full on New Hope. Like it's like every beat is there.
Well, because it's written by Josh Friedman, who wrote the Avatar sequel.
Yeah, and it makes sense. Like it has, it's quite
The Way of Water.
It's quite simple minded and it's like what it's going for. But it's so weird. I think. We talked about this off mic. I think the hardest thing for me was, again, watching nine films in this franchise leading up, right? Remakes and, you know, reboots. All of them have some sort of socially conscious bent. This has nothing on its mind. And it pretends like it does toward the end, and it falls flat.
I think there's one good idea in this movie that it kind of stretches out to 2.5 hours. And it's the idea of like Caesar becomes the lawgiver.
Yeah.
Essentially, the guy who passes down.
How do you bastardize what they said?
And yeah, how do you take like if Caesar, right down to the crucifixion imagery from War of the Planet of the Apes, becomes like their Jesus Christ, and it becomes about like how do people utilize or pervert a Messiah's teachings.
Yeah.
To their own advantage or to their own
their own
edification or their own betterment.
Yeah, it's no, and that's totally there. And I think that
But that's it. That's the only idea it's got. The rest is just a kind of straight ahead YA adventure. Because it's all teenage Planet of the Apes. Like, it's all teenage apes.
Yep. It's them and them plus the teenage girl, you know. The human.
Who's Nova?
Nova, yep.
There's a lot of weird callback. That's the other thing that I found distracting about this movie. Now, we're talking about this movie. We're starting pretty negative with it, but I would like to clarify, like, I think this is pretty good.
No,
it's actually good.
It's totally fine, and I think the only place it fails is just not being as good as Matt Reeves, like, or as Rupert Wyatt, right? Like,
right.
It's coming after three really, really good, like, and also, I also think they tried to do more with the CG in this one, and it actually ends up looking worse. Like
I see. My thing is, I actually think this is a good ass looking movie.
I don't agree. I
don't concur.
No, I mean, for me, there's just moments of like I think about Dawn and War, and there's moments in War. I'm like, it's just photoreal. Like they're going all in.
Oh sure.
And this is also Weta. It's the same people. But I think this one was a little bit faster and looser, it felt like to me. And also there's a lot more characters like moving, a lot more happening on screen in some
There's
of the
a
scenes.
Lot more characters that aren't defined.
Yeah.
To that, I think that's the biggest that's failing of the movie is that none of these characters, right down to Owen Teague's lead.
Yeah.
Like they're all well performed, but like
they're kind of generic looking.
None of them. Well, not only are they generic looking, but like none of them are intriguing in the way Caesar is or Koba is or like Maurice is. Like you get one good character,
Raka.
Speaking of Maurice, Raka, who's the best part of the movie. And then I guess, spoiler alert, they kill him like an hour into the film and all the air goes right out of the movie.
No, when you meet Raka, he's full on. He's Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's the teacher of the past, right?
Because he's keeping the books.
He's keeping the books, and he's also capturing. He's part of like the Order of Caesar, right? So it's these priests, which is fucking cool, who all have these pendants.
You know who he most reminds me of?
Who?
If we're going to make the Star Wars comparison in a movie that you don't particularly like, he's Mark Hamill in Return in
Last Jedi.
Last Jedi. right down to keeping the books.
Talk about taking the air out of the room. You know, talking about Last Jedi here, but
I mean, one of the best Star Wars movies.
But no, Raka is. We're totally in agreement on that. Maybe not Last Jedi, but Raka is. Because again, Noah as a lead is so kind of milquetoast as a main character at low, yeah. You know, that you Raka is just like the spice of the movie. And like you have Freya Allen playing for most of it, this silent girl named, you know, Nova, this human. She's not bringing anything. It's not her fault, but she's just this like blank character. Yeah. And I like her. I liked her in The Witcher show. And like she's a good actress, but like.
I liked her in The Witcher show. A sentence that nobody else on this planet has uttered.
I watched a little bit, and she's good. But I, as you said, though, this film takes a turn when it gets to the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes with Kevin Durant's Proximus Caesar. He's taken Caesar's mantle in his own way, and the name Caesar to literally be a Roman Caesar, like he,
yeah, Proximus Caesar. It's a literal, like,
it's like a fucking Mad Max character,
exactly. Yeah,
Proximus Caesar. We're about to see the new one next week, like
Dementus. Homunculus.
Yeah, yeah, or like a Morton Joe, that kind of name, right? Or Dementus for Chris Hemsworth. But when it shows up there.
Nobody named people better than George Miller.
No, he's still the best at it. I mean, Furiosa, Imperator Furiosa, like
Lord Humongous.
I mean, just we're gonna have to watch that in a minute too. But there's something about I think where this film fails
the Ayatollah of rock and roll
is when they get to the kingdom. And it wants to have its cake and eat it, too. It wants to be this YA thing. And it wants to have higher things on its mind and have this, like, kind of hitting a theme that I read a review. They're like, this film is just confusing because I don't know what they're trying to say. Because, like, there's this whole speech where they're like, she says, can we ever get along? Like, where was this in the narrative? It's just like they tack it on at the end that she's kind of working for the humans. But are they bad? Are they good? I don't fucking know. Like.
I don't think the movie does either.
No, it doesn't. It's really confused. The film is not confusing. It's confused. It doesn't know what it's trying to get across.
I think what's weird about it is that in a franchise that throughout its almost 60 years of history,
yeah,
has been very almost aggressive in its implementation of a point of view,
yeah,
this movie does not have one. And again, it's 2.5 hours long. Which is far too long, but it moves along in a nice quip. It's super fun to watch. I think it looks better than you're leading on. I think the performances are good. Like, overall, pretty entertaining 3.5-star movie, let's say.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have anything going on under the hood, which is the biggest disappointment. It just delivers the nuts and bolts. In a lot of ways, it reminds me most of Battle for the Planet, yeah, of the Apes, where Battle for the Planet of the Apes, I think one of the biggest kind of detriments to that movie is that it almost feels like an approximation of what Arthur P. Jacobs thought that people liked about the Apes movies. It's a real blood from a stone kind of production, to where it's almost like, oh, what do they like? They like Roddy McDowell. They like humans who are mutants living underground, yeah. They'll end up like having a war. There's some kind of dorm room philosophizing with the Paul Williams character.
Yeah.
But like outside of that, it's a pretty straight ahead, just kind of adventure film that doesn't really have a point of view. Like Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is kind of the same thing, is that it's almost like it takes any of the raw intention of especially the Matt Reeves movies,
oh,
and just,
man,
strips it completely. And it's just like, what if we just made this into a very diverting YA adventure romp and really nothing more?
Yep. No, I agree. But again, I think that's where it fails, is where it tries to do a little bit more in the second half, especially with Proximus.
Does it try to do something?
I think
more?
With Proximus, like he is trying, they're trying to have him say, have this kind of profound thing. I think that the vault is supposed to be symbolic. And I don't quite know of what. Like, I know that it's like our
weapon.
The vault
is the biggest letdown, because it's almost like Proxima Caesar's goal is to open this vault. Like, he's created this kind of mini kingdom by the sea that's walled in, and they have this vault that he's, like, literally sacrificing apes in the service of to try and
which
open.
Is a cool idea.
And, like, you brought up Immortan Joe and everything, and that reminded me a lot of Fury Road, that whole sequence where they're strapping the chains onto it and trying to take it down. Like, it felt like a George Miller moment. And I kind of sat up in my seat, and I was like, oh, okay, where are we going here? Like, this kind of seems interesting. But then when you get into the vault, it's just military weapons. And you're like, there's a real... I guess this sums up kind of the flaw, or the main flaw of the movie overall, is that there's a whole, like, that's it? Sort of kind of question at its core that never gets answered, is that, like, it never elevates or even attempts to elevate itself above just being a pretty standard, you know, again, young adult adventure.
Well, because you have, I mean... They tell you what it is, and it's, she says, there's a book in there. There's something in there that will teach us to speak again. And it's that
which
stupid...
I also don't get. It was like, to your point, is like, is she supposed to be working for the humans the whole time?
Yeah.
She's on this quest to get, like, this SATCOM card that they plug in. But, like, again, and maybe this is just my devotion to the series as a whole, is that when you get to the reveal at the end, when she returns... I guess spoilers for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, y'all. But, like, when she gets that SATCOM card back to her human base at the end, and they plug it in, and all the satellites start syncing up, and you realize that there's more humans still left in this world, I sat up, and I was like, I will go see another Planet of the Apes movie. And maybe, again, that's my devotion to the series, but I did, like, I was interested in what happens next.
That's the thing, is I am now invested.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, even, like, I don't, again, like you said, this is a solid, I think for me, 3 stars. I don't, like, especially the first hour, I really, really like.
All the eagle stuff is fucking dope.
It's literally.
Apes training eagles. It's the Dark Tower. Badass. Yeah, it's awesome.
It's full on Roland from the Dark Tower.
Yeah.
Training the hawk. It's like, oh, they're fucking pulling on Stephen King. Okay, I'm in.
Yeah,
like, it added this new thing of something we hadn't seen before, of, like, it's a new tribe we haven't met. You know, it's full on throwing into this world. I like him fixing the shock bar thing he has.
Yeah.
It's almost like his lightsaber. It's like he has this weapon, this old tech weapon that he's working on.
See, I never thought about the Luke Skywalker kind of parallels until you brought that up.
It's just full on.
Oh, yeah, you're right. This is kind of just like it's New Hope.
Yeah, and I again, like, Campbell works for a reason. It's fucking archetypal, you know.
We both
know that. And so, like, I like all of that, and the more it strays from that, because at first I was like, okay, cool, they're just gonna do Star Wars, Planet of the Apes. I'm like, that's fine.
Yeah, they're just doing Skywalker.
Yeah, I was like, if you don't have the brains to do, like, the deep social stuff and you want to do YA, I'm cool with that. But again, I feel like they try to kind of dip their toe into that in the end. And I'm like, it kind of falls flat. The one thing I do like, though, is one of the kind of, like, climax is they blast open this dam and they flood the vault. I like the way.
See, this is where the movie actually lost me. Is I thought the end set piece was so generic that I was just kind of zoning out at that point.
That's fair.
Also, it doesn't help that you're in hour 8 of the movie.
Well, and I also was like, I was already kind of out of the movie by then. And once that happened, I'm like, okay, this is very Cameron-y. Mm-hmm. His fight with the giant gorilla is, like, the way he kills him is just by being smaller and smarter. It was full on Avatar 2 or the Abyss, like water coming through spaces and people pushing through, like, bars and pipes and stuff.
No, it's well done. It's just we've seen it before.
Yeah, it's like, and I think that's what Wes Ball, like, I mean, again, I haven't watched a full movie besides this of his, but watching this.
I don't know you, Wes Ball. But I don't like you.
It just seems like he's a capable filmmaker.
Yeah, he just seems perfectly competent.
But he just doesn't have anything on his mind. Like, he's not. Reeves came in with, like, I have themes in my mind.
Of in the same way that he did with the Batman, is that he was like, I have a specific way that I want to make this movie.
Mm-hmm. even when he remade, you know, Let the Right One In, but as Let Me In, he was like, it wasn't just a flat remake. He was like, I have things I want to do. And I actually like that movie a lot. And or even back to Cloverfield, which I think is one of the best found footage films ever. You know, I'm still a big fan of that fucking movie. I mean, he came in and was like, 75 minutes? Let's fucking go. You know?
I mean, Let Me In, to your point, like, is one of the few remakes that some people make the argument might actually be better than the original.
I think it might be.
I don't know about
it. I like the original a lot.
Richard Jenkins is so fucking good in that movie.
Yeah, and also Cody Smith-McKee I like a lot, too. And Chloe Grace Moretz are both, like, really, really good. They don't have the ethereal quality of the girl specifically in the original Swedish film. Like, she's so, like, seems like a...
Cody Smith-McPhee is really having a Jackie Earl Haley moment, though, as he gets older.
Dude.
Poor kid.
I know, man. He's a goofy-looking kid. I really like him in Dawn. I think he's really sweet.
You know what's one of the moments in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes that I totally forgot? That, like, even when it happened, I was like, this is so specific and fucking weird.
The black hole thing?
The black hole thing. Where he teaches Maurice to read using the black hole, this underground graphic novel.
Crazy comic.
About fucking kids turning into mutants after they get STDs. Like, weird movie that Fincher wanted to make into a film for, like, years.
It's a great graphic novel. It's actually amazing.
No, it's amazing.
Like, it's kind of mind-blowing.
But, like,
mind-blowing.
It's just such a specific reference for Reeves to kind of harness into the movie.
Yeah. I like Reeves a lot. Like, I don't think he's perfect, but he definitely has... He's a reader and a watcher.
Oh, he's you know? Got the goods.
Yeah.
So, Martin, this has been great.
Oh, man, what a fun bunch of movies.
I'm so glad that you enjoyed this as much as we did. We are trying to get on a more regular schedule, so we actually have like 4 or 5 episodes planned out. But you're going to have to tune in next time to find out what we're going to do past Planet of the Apes on Secret Handshake. Stay tuned.
See you next time.
Later.
I hate every ape I see, from chimpanzee to chimpanzee. No, you'll never make a monkey out of me. Oh my God, I was wrong. It was Earth all along. You finally made a monkey.
Yes, we finally made a monkey.
Yes, you finally made a monkey out of me. I love you, Dr. Zayas.